Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Oh, the world is going through them changes. But the war in Afghanistan continues 16 years later, with no end in sight and predictions that it could continue at least another 10 years. Scott Horton from antiwar.com and the Scott Horton Podcast joins me today to talk about his new book, which is called Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. And I think Scott does a great job of recapping the events that led us into this unfathomable conflict. And we talk a lot about the various factors, domestic and international considerations. I think you'll find it a rewarding interview, and I'm glad you've downloaded it. And before I introduce Scott, I want to thank the people who make all this possible by subscribing to the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Folks like Paul Tomaselli, Cynthia Von Hendricks, and Natalie Reel. And I want to give special mention to Robert Blumen, who is a subscriber here and supports Scott Horton as well. You can join in here at peterbcollins.com. Just click on over and click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber, and in a couple of minutes, you can set up a subscription that fits your budget. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting my work.
Why are we there? It is fair to ask, how long will 9/11 justify the task?
Scott Horton's new book is an indictment of our ongoing war in Afghanistan. And it's called Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. Our opening music today was sent to me 7 years ago by a composer from Seattle and a radio listener named John Neems. And it's his personal pain about the pain of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and the endless war there. You may know Scott Horton. He's a fellow podcaster. He is the opinion editor at antiwar.com. He's the host of Anti-War Radio, which is heard on Pacifica Station in Los Angeles and a few other outlets. He's the host of the Scott Horton Podcast at scotthorton.org, and he is managing director of the Libertarian Institute. He joins us from Texas today. Scott, it's good to be with you.
Thank you very much for having me. Good to talk to you.
And let's blame Robert Blumen. He is a fan of both of us, and he wrote me about a month ago, told me about your new book. And I was delighted to hear about it. I've had a chance to read it. And you've really served up some very important information and a strong argument for a U.S. exit from Afghanistan. But
Thanks to Robert.
Yeah. I went over to antiwar.com just before we started talking, and a report from Jason Ditz quotes Senator Bob Corker, who's announced he will not stay in the Senate after he completes this term. But the headline reads, U.S. will likely have troops in Afghanistan for the next decade. That's not really surprising, but it sure is disappointing, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is.
And what drives that, Scott?
Well, I mean, this is my best answer, I think, is just to quote Obi-Wan Kenobi from Episode 2, which is arguably the worst of the Star Wars movies, although I think Episode 1 was worse, frankly. But anyway, somewhere in there, Anakin says to Obi-Wan, oh, no, not another lecture about the economics of politics. Because Obi-Wan is explaining about how it's pretty easy to sponsor a senator, and then the senator now has access to the treasury and can pay you back far more than it costs to bribe him. And that's the form of the American system. You know, when people say Afghanistan is the most corrupt country in the world, they're kind of right, but of course you can't exclude the United States. And Washington, D.C. is itself just a big imperial court. You know, there is no law or constitution or republic anymore. It's just the national security state and just a big bunch of grifters. In fact, I think it was Stephen Bannon who said in that 60 Minutes interview when they challenged him, he said, listen, 7 of the 8 wealthiest counties in America are in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., right? Yeah. It's not New York City. It's not Silicon Valley. I guess Silicon Valley is the 8th. But it's Washington, D.C., because there is literally a $3 trillion a year pot of honey.
Well, and the
and
profit,
if you
the
have
profiteering,
the access to reach your hand in,
the profiteering has just expanded since 9/11. And
that's
we not only have the old military-industrial complex, but we have to overlay the so-called homeland security apparatus. I hate that term. We have to look at the surveillance establishment that used to be focused on other parts of the world and now is heavily focused on domestic communications. And all of this produces a bounty for contractors, for retired military people who serve on the boards of these companies and are not identified as such when they appear on CNN to promote the next war.
That's right. Well, and of course, the bureaucracies themselves, every one of those bureaucrats and as an institution and the individual bureaucrats themselves in not just the CIA, right, but in each of the different departments of the CIA, right? The analysts, the operations guys, the special activities division, and all the different managers up on the whatever floor and where they all have their interests as subgroups of the groups and this and that. And then, of course, all the different agencies that you mentioned, the in the security establishment, and of course the military itself. And this is, you know, if you ask Gareth Porter, he will always say it's the generals. The generals, they are the core of the empire. They're the ones who make the decisions, and they're the ones who ultimately can never admit that what they're doing isn't working and that they should just quit instead. They're the ones who have to always double down. McMaster, they say, wants a do-over in Afghanistan. He was literally on the McChrystal Petraeus team that failed in the surge of 2009 through 12 to deliver on their promises. And now he wants, quote, a do-over. Because we can't just fire the Pentagon and hire a new security force, right? We're stuck with these guys. And they have the power to tax, the power to inflate, the power to borrow. And, you know, they have the world empire, and they're clearly not going to give it up easily. You know, it's going to probably take, as Ron Paul always says, when people finally lose confidence in the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
Is when the empire will finally fall apart, just as all empires eventually do.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Scott Horton here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. He is the Scott Horton from antiwar.com and the other outlets that I mentioned. There is another Scott Horton who's been a guest on my program many times. He's the guy who lectures in law at Columbia, writes a lot about Guantanamo, and also publishes in Harper's Magazine. Have you guys ever met?
Oh, yeah. We've met in person, and also I've interviewed him on my show for, you know, dozens and dozens of times going back to 2005 as well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's a real hero.
You know, it's interesting to me, Scott, as I looked at your footnotes and your sourcing and also reviewed some of your recent podcasts. You and I come from different angles. I'm an unreconstructed liberal who's operating to the left of the Democratic Party, and you define yourself as a libertarian. But we talk to a lot of the same people who we find credible and whose views we respect. You mentioned Gareth Porter, Phil Giraldi, Joe Lauria, John Kiriakou, the former CIA guy, Tim Shorrock, Peter Van Buren, Colonel Basevich. You know, it's really interesting to me where there is some overlap between the disaffected left and the libertarian community.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, I basically, the reason I'm such a good fit with antiwar.com, it's not so much that Justin Raimondo and I see eye to eye on everything, but it's the editorial approach overall at antiwar.com is we're all libertarians, but we don't give a damn what you are. We only care about the policy. We care about the worst thing in the world right now, which is the American world empire and its violence and at our expense. And so Pat Buchanan, we run him, Daniel Ellsberg, whoever you got from wherever on the spectrum. And so that's just, you know, always been my attitude, too. So that's why I always loved antiwar.com so much. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm perfectly happy to interview the Reds. I often do. And that's liberals to progressives to socialists and legit communists and anarcho-communists. And I don't care about that. It's all, in fact, it's, you know, very, very rarely I ever interview anyone based on who they are at all. It's virtually always by the article. If the article is good enough that I want to know more about it, that's the only qualification. In fact, I was just interviewed by Thaddeus Russell and for his podcast, and he said that he had been warned by libertarians that, yeah, you can't, don't listen to the Scott Horton show because, you know, he and his guests, they're all very suspect. And I just thought, you know, I am very suspect, okay? But my guests, pardon me, sir, but I have immaculate and impeccable taste in guests. You know, you just named a whole bunch of them. And Gareth Porter, of course, is the very best of the best. But the reason I'm good on all of this stuff is because I know Patrick Coburn. I talk to him, you know, at least once a month, and I have for years and years and years. So nothing sneaks up on me, but all the credit goes to them. You know, my only thing is I'm, you know, okay with the follow-up questions, and I try to do a lot of reading. But yeah, I and for that matter, I should say there's a whole part of the anti-war right, the paleo-conservative movement centered around the American Conservative magazine, but somewhat broader than that, which is founded in opposition to American empire. You know, Pat Buchanan is really the exemplar of this, who people are surprised to find out that he's not a war hawk, in fact. But what happened was at the end of the Cold War, he and Jude Winiski and some other of these Cold War, you know, very anti-communist, very pro-Reagan brinksmanship, anti-detente and pro-brinksmanship Cold Warriors, when the Soviet Union fell apart, they said, all right, that's it. We won. Let's abolish NATO. Let's bring the troops home. We don't want to be the empire of the world. We just want to be a republic. And this whole thing about being the empire of the world, that was promised to be just for the duration of the emergency, to contain evil expansionist Soviet atheist communism. But now that that's gone, that's it. We had a deal, right? And then the deal, of course, was broken. Chalmers Johnson, this was his problem too. Sure. When the empire stayed after the end of the Cold War, Chalmers Johnson said, hey, what about the deal? About how this was all just for the duration of the emergency. Aha, I've been had. It really was, you know, Soviet communism was the excuse for the American empire, not the reason for it, just like with terrorism in our current age.
Well, and you make that point in a number of different ways in the new book, Fool's Errand. And one of my major takeaways from your book, Scott, is that this war in Afghanistan, now we got to count again, it's 16 years on, it grinds on because the occupation continues. And, you know, we've kind of exhausted the serial excuses. Oh, it was Al-Qaeda. Oh, it's the Taliban. Oh, you know, we've got to prop up the Karzai government. And we're now in this kind of bizarre phase where Trump, who had signaled that he didn't want to support regime change invasion wars, showed us in August that he is deeply pained, but that he's going along with the generals. And he's announced his own mini surge. So this really defies the intentions. Obama, you know, had said he wanted to get out of Iraq, but his ploy to avoid being labeled as a peacenik was to say, this is the war that matters. And he had two surges into Afghanistan, both obvious failures. And now we're really going back to the drawing board for a little more what you describe as the work of the Coindinistas, the counterintelligence, counterinsurgency people who work off of the David Petraeus playbook.
Right. Well, and listen, I mean, they admit this happened just last week. A reporter, I think quite innocently, asked the Secretary of Defense, what are the metrics? That's their term for, you know, their new speak for how do you measure, what are your benchmarks or whatever for determining whether you're achieving success or not. Forget victory, okay, but success. We're going to have some success. So the reporter asked, so what are your metrics for success, Mr. Secretary of Defense. And he said, well, yeah, you know, I don't know. We don't know. But guess what? I'm going to go to Europe, and we're going to meet in Brussels with some of our NATO friends, and we're going to talk about it and things like that. And then maybe at the end we'll come up with even what we're going to claim we're attempting to accomplish, which you and I already know that they cannot accomplish, which they will never say out loud, and which is part of the reason probably why they can't accomplish this, because they won't admit exactly what mission they're even on, which ultimately is the pacification of the Pashtun population of the east and south of that country, and who would much rather fight and have the ability and the weapons to, many of them left behind by the Americans in their last few escalations. And they have safe haven in Pakistan, which for various reasons is not going to stop supporting them. And so that's it. You know, I often try to make the comparison to Iraq War II, where as horrible as that was, it made sense ultimately in a rational way to say that America will be able to succeed in installing the 60% supermajority population of the country, the Shiite Arabs, and their political parties in power in the capital city. They just had to commit a horrible ethnic cleansing campaign that ended up causing a civil war that killed, you know, right around 1 million people in Iraq War II in order to achieve that. But everybody knew that at the end of the day, the Shiite Arabs were 60%. The Sunni Arabs were only 20%. And the Kurdish Iraqis, which were the other 20%, they were in alliance with the Shiite supermajority against the Sunni Arabs. And so ultimately, yeah, it took 8 years of bloodshed, but then it, quote unquote, worked. Of course, you know, the Shiite government ended up basically abandoning the Sunni west of the country and allowing it to fall into the hands of the Islamic State, which was also Obama's fault for Syria policy. But anyway, the comparison is, in Afghanistan, we're fighting for a coalition of small minority groups against the plurality of the country. So there is no ethnic group that's the single majority in Afghanistan.
Right.
But the Pashtuns are the plurality of at least 40% and possibly more. And so we're trying to foist a coalition of Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras, and others, Turkmen and others, you know, into this coalition government and trying to foist their rule on the people from the Pashtun South. And it's just never going to work. It's not going to work. You know, it's interesting. I was talking with Daniel Davis, who is a great whistleblower. He's featured in the book, The Great Whistleblower, from 2012 at the end of the Afghan surge, explaining why it couldn't work. And I said, Mance, was it really like this where, you know, the entire Iraqi army is basically just nothing but Tajiks and maybe some Hazaras and Uzbeks, but mostly it's all Tajiks and run by the Tajiks against the Pashtuns? And he goes, well, you know, it's funny because there actually are divisions where there is some Pashtun participation in the government, but they're never sent to their own areas. They're always sent somewhere else. And the Uzbeks and the Hazaras will be sent to the Pashtun areas. And now this is under the theory that, well, if they're not from there, then they'll just be kind of impartial law enforcement types and won't really have a dog in the fight. When, of course, that's completely stupid and wrong, right? That's like, you know, having a foreign country come to America and hiring minority black militias to come and rule over the white suburbs and packing them with force. And this is not a plan for long-term success against the 60% majority here. You can see it's a poor analogy, but you get it.
No, I get it. So, and Scott, in the book, you point out several times that the U.S. has settled scores by being misled or just led by the nose by these various factions and tribal elements in Afghanistan, because we don't know who these people are. We don't know the territory, as the music man would say.
Right. And I don't mean to, you know, I was kind of worried about the way I phrased that, because I didn't want to say like, oh, yeah, those sneaky Asiatic savages taking advantage of our well-meaning, honest Boy Scout warriors over there trying to do the right thing. I mean, there's an element of truth in that. And yet, of course, the context is America has turned the country to chaos. Everyone is desperately poor. Everyone is desperately everything. And so people are in the position of, just like in my education as a youth about what it was like to live in totalitarian communism in Eastern Europe under the domination of the Soviet Union, where People rat on their neighbor just out of fear that their neighbor's going to rat on them first, even though nobody even did anything. But it's just who's going to be the last guy left standing in the neighborhood doing the best accusing of the others before they get him? Because that's what you're all saddled with, is that kind of secret police force. So that these are the kinds of choices that people are left to make in the circumstances in which they find themselves. So, but yes, then in fact, you do have American soldiers rotate in from wherever. Maybe they just got there from Iraq or got there from Germany or got there from Missouri or wherever, show up. And then the local mayor says, oh, yeah, you know who we need to get is these guys over here. They're the Taliban. They're the terrorists. They're the bad guys. And the Americans say, all right, hoo-wah, right, and go off and basically do what they're told. And, yes, this has happened over and over and over again, where you have people who absolutely were anti-Taliban forces who got rounded up, shot, tortured, sent off to Guantanamo Bay, you know, buried in a ditch somewhere and nobody knows. People who had no problem with anyone. And then Anand Gopal really should get all the credit here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I borrowed so much from his great work in the book. And he just talks about, yeah, in the case of this valley here, and in the case of this valley here, and the famous Korangal Valley, the Valley of Death, and these other places in this community, in this district, in this province, what happened was way back in 2006, the GIs killed this guy that everybody loved, who was sort of the patriarch of the county. And man, ever since then, they've just had insurgency that they don't know what to do with. And the only reason they killed him was because somebody told them, you know, for their own narrow interests, that this guy needed to be gotten rid of, and ended up with terrible consequences. So it's, you know, blowback on the highest level and then all the way down to the lowest level is just swimming in the consequences of all the previous missions.
And let me just
like
add that
the war is part of all the previous interventions.
Let me just add that Anand Gopal also was the one who exposed the night raids that the U.S. was running, which just compounded the whole process that you described. Because, you know, we just roust people in the middle of the night. We really don't know who we're dealing with. We rely on some informant who may have an agenda that we're not aware of. And we end up just almost on a nightly basis making things worse. He also exposed the black sites that were scattered around Afghanistan, where we were detaining people in an Abu Ghraib or Bagram, the salt pit, in that kind of a very barbaric detention facility. So I agree. He did a lot of great work and exposed quite a bit.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm grateful for him also coming on my show and, you know, answering follow-up questions and helping me out, you know, when I had a couple of questions to clarify and that kind of thing, so... He's mm-hmm. a great guy, and he gave me a great blurb for the book, too.
Now, Scott, one thing I'm curious about that I didn't really get a clear line on in the book is, do you believe the official 9/11 narrative? Because you very clearly see it as the springboard that was used to push a lot of bad policy and push us into the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I don't get a clear idea of your position on the... you know, the 9/11 Commission report and whether you consider that to be accurate.
Well, honestly, I never read the 9/11 Commission report because I would rather get it from good journalists that I trust than from some government commission that, you know, all mm-hmm. their sources are basically directly from the police and intelligence agencies themselves. But, you know, I've read... Peter Lance and Terry McDermott and James Bamford has two different books about September 11th, mm-hmm. Pretext for War and the Shadow Factory.
Sure.
And The Looming Tower and this, that, and the other thing. The Black Banners by Ali Soufan and I don't know. So more or less my take is, yeah, Al-Qaeda did it. I mean, the whole thing, oh, yeah, boo-hoo, they hate us because we're free and white and Christian and innocent and Islam makes people evil and all this. To me... Yeah, I mean, that is what George Bush said and all that, but we're grown-ups, so let's not get, you know, hung up on straw men and all of that. I mean, the real deal is that these guys went to war against the United States way back in 1989 was their first hit. Here was the assassination of the Rabbi Kahane in New York City, and that was the same crew that ended up doing the World Trade Center and then the thwarted, ultimately, plots against the Holland and Lincoln Tunnels and the UN building there. The Blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman's group.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, Peter Lance in his book, A Thousand Years for Revenge, it's told from the point of view of basically like the FBI agents, not the bosses, but the actual cops doing the work who really want to do the work, at least in their telling of it, and how really because their bosses kept screwing everything up and refusing to let them do their jobs in the first place, each and every attack through the 90s really could have been prevented if only they had followed up on all their leads and told the whole story as best they could and done their best work on the last attack, and how this chain happened all through the 1990s where they kept refusing basically to follow up or to follow through completely, because then they would implicate themselves for they could have stopped this one if they had done the work from last time. And how, you know, in his telling, that, you know, basically chain lasted all the way through the September 11th attacks. And then I think, I mean, it sounds like a limited hangout. I understand that. But I think it's just so plausible and real and even provable in so many ways, the manner in which the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA refused to cooperate with each other and, you know, think of the American people first and their job of, you know, providing security for us aside. And instead, you know, they went ahead and they think of themselves first. Again, the economics of politics and bureaucracy. And so they just refuse to share anything with each other. As you know, the FBI and the CIA get all the blame for that, but the NSA wouldn't share anything with either of them.
Right.
As Bamford shows in The Shadow Factory. Mm-hmm. And this is huge. I mean, this is absolutely the kind of thing. And, you know, I just, most people give these guys the benefit of the doubt. Most people say that, you know, listen, they're the most powerful country. In fact, I just saw a bunch of tweets like this the other day, you know, about Puerto Rico. We got the most power. We just spent $700 billion on the military. And why can't we get relief to Puerto Rico? Well, because that's not what the empire's for. You know, it's, who would expect them to actually do that job or do any of their jobs well? Especially, you know, look at Afghanistan. They haven't accomplished a damn thing there. Attacks happen right under their nose every day there. You know, a suicide bomber blew up seven CIA guys at a base in Coast Province, right? I'm sure that wasn't an inside job. It was a double agent inside job for the Al-Qaeda guys is what it was, right? Pretended to be an informant for them.
Right.
So anyway, you know, on the other hand, I guess I'll say too, as long as we're talking about this, that I was a truther before it happened. I was a New World Order kook in the 90s. And, you know, I knew that the war on terrorism was coming for years. Before the attack ever happened. And I just assumed that everybody knew. I certainly knew that George Bush was going to be the president and that we were going to go to war against Iraq and then probably Afghanistan. I assumed at the time that Osama bin Laden was just a CIA agent and that the whole thing was just a ruse. And then after the attack, I actually decided that maybe I would hold my horses and try to actually learn a little bit more instead of just going with all my assumptions and leaping to conclusions. And what I saw was the truthers cherry picking and making up nonsense in just the same way that Richard Perle and the neocons were cherry picking and making up nonsense in order to pin it on Saddam. That both of their methods were basically, let's just make money by making a case that seems to fit. And I guess to me, the case that seems to fit best is, if, well, the worst case for the truther thing, I think, would be if the Saudis, you know, very intentionally, like in, if you take the worst interpretation of the 28 pages, if Saudi intelligence very deliberately helped these guys do it, then that raises real questions about whether they thought they had permission to do so on the American side, from at least some people in some positions to let them get away with it. But I don't know, man, that's a pretty big treason. I mean, even if you're Dick Cheney and you're going to approve something like that, you're taking a risk that some general might just take you out back and shoot you and then nuke Riyadh and say, oh, yeah, how do you like that?
Well,
right.
I'll
I mean,
just say
so
this,
I really just don't know, man.
Yeah.
I don't know.
OK,
that's my
and,
real answer.
And I respect that. And you know, you're not casual about it or just, you know, embracing a kind of consensus position. And I don't want to get into a debate about this. I just want to say that I remain a skeptic. I, too, am, you know, ambivalent about some of the extreme truthers. And my position is that the official narrative doesn't hold up to close scrutiny and that the 9/11 Commission was a whitewash. And I went to Washington and observed their work, and I feel pretty strongly that that is the case.
I don't think there's any question about that part.
But to there are people who then jump to, oh, it was an inside job. Well, I don't know that. I know that the official story doesn't stand up to scientific scrutiny, and it doesn't pass fundamental bullshit tests. But that doesn't mean that I know who did it and why and exactly, you know, what forces were put in motion. But we do know who benefited from it and how it was used. And
yeah, I mean, let me say, I guess my real answer should have been, I was asked this at the speech the other day in L.A., and I should have said the same thing to you, which is that they might as well have done it. I mean, the degree, the level of cynicism with which the Bush administration exploited the September 11th attack, I can see why, just with that information right there, you might just be forced to conclude that they must have done it. Because if they hadn't, how could they possibly be such bastards to say, aha, now that we got all 300 million Americans crying their eyes out, we got them right where we want them. And we can manipulate them and frighten them, scare everybody's mom into supporting the next war, make them think they're going to die from the next orange alert if we don't let them attack Iraq. It was the worst thing. Just, you know, I lived through 2002 and 3, and I'll never forget it. You know, I'll never forgive them for what they did. And I could see how people, you know, just, you know, would be unable to understand that degree of cynicism in taking advantage of that crisis to get away with the agenda that they got away with without thinking that they must have been behind the whole thing in the first place. But then again, they do the same thing every time there's a hurricane. You know, when after Katrina, when Bush refused to order anybody to do anything for like 6 days, he goes, you know, the lesson here is that from now on, the Army needs to be able to take the lead and do whatever they want whenever they want. Right. I mean, that was no inside job. That's just whenever there's a crisis, they're going to always exploit it, no matter what, they to get away with whatever they can.
And there were Blackwater security officers on the streets of New Orleans. We know that. Scott, where I want to go next is an area where you echo something that I've been saying for a long time. And that is, by invading Afghanistan and Iraq, Bush fulfilled the wildest dreams of Osama bin Laden. And I say that even if I can't establish, you know, exactly what al-Qaeda did and to what extent they were directly responsible and to what extent they were simply taking credit. But the idea of seducing or somehow, you know, persuading the United States to commit our forces to the graveyard of empires and to Islamic soil in Iraq after the provocation of having U.S. troops on the holiest Islamic soil in Saudi Arabia, this really was something that the al-Qaeda folks never could have really imagined would come through for them as far as it did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's a big part of why I think al-Qaeda did it, is because the means and the motive and the opportunity, it's all there. I quote in the book, Osama bin Laden's son, his non-terrorist son, there's a few of them, but he has a non-terrorist son named Omar, who sat down in a nightclub in Damascus, Syria in 2010 and talked to Rolling Stone magazine and said, and, you know, I don't know, you could always just pretend and make up that, hey, maybe someone put him up to it or whatever, but to me, it's just too perfect. Mm-hmm. He goes, look, my father's dream was to lure the Americans to Afghanistan, to replicate the 1980s war against the Russians, to bog them down, bleed them to bankruptcy, break them, and force them out. And he said that when George Bush won out in the Florida recount contest in the year 2000, that Osama bin Laden was so pleased because he could take one look at George W. Bush and see the perfect mark. That here's a guy who's going to take every possible advantage to exploit this thing. And, you know, in fact, I remember thinking when I was just after September 11th, when I was trying to still hold my horses and not jump to conclusions, even though my confirmation bias had just been proved so right, seemingly. I remember thinking, you know, if these guys really are separate terrorists from the American regime and they really did this for their own reasons, well, they must have been crazy if they thought that, what, we're going to turn around and run home. But then, of course, it was William Norman Grigg, the late, great, heroic William Norman Grigg, who then was the editor of the John Birch Society's magazine, The New American, who said, listen, you know, he quoted Saul Alinsky, actually, the action in terrorism or in any real asymmetric political act, which can be not necessarily terrorism. But the action is in the reaction of the opposition. And so if you are a group of 400 professional terrorists who can't go home and can't get a job, and you got nothing left to do but go to war against America, how the hell do you go to war against America, the most powerful world empire ever, times 1,000, with 7,000 H-bombs and every advantage at our disposal? Well, what you do is you give them the opportunity to shoot themselves in the foot and bleed them out slowly. And that's exactly what they did. And it makes perfect sense. And bin Laden before 9/11 was there's a great book called The Secret History of Al-Qaeda by Abdel Bari Atwan, who is the editor of Al-Quds or Arabi in London. And he went and spent the weekend with Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan in 1997 or 8 and wrote all about him. And he absolutely explained that this was what he was up to in no uncertain terms, and explained that during Black Hawk Down, the episode with the Army Rangers who were killed in Mogadishu in 1993, which was a George Bush Sr. operation that was left with Bill Clinton and then run into the ground there, that he was disappointed when America left, that he wanted to drag America into a war of attrition right then and there, a war that they couldn't win, trying to conquer Somalia that would just end up bleeding them dry and ruining everything. And I guess screw the Somalis. He didn't even mention all the innocent people who were supposed to die. But then it was the same thing with Afghanistan. And people cite his later claims that, oh, yeah, see, the Americans turned and ran when we bombed them in Somalia, as proof that somehow he thought we'd turn and run when they did September 11th. But that was, you know, possibly what they wanted us to think in order to make the reaction stick better. And in fact, you know, I think that Donald Rumsfeld understood this. At least he argued it cynically as a reason to not get too bogged down in Afghanistan. Let's focus on going to Iraq, guys. And he would then even cite the, hey, they want to bog us down. They want to replicate the thing against the Russians. Anybody could have told you that, you know, when they were being honest, just as I quote Paul Wolfowitz in the book, admitting that the reason they attacked us is because we had troops in Saudi Arabia. And then he invokes that as a reason to invade Iraq so we can move the bases out of Saudi Arabia.
Scott, in the book Fool's Errand, you write, in short, America fell for it. U.S. political and military leaders exploited the September 11th attacks to get away with pursuing unrelated agendas, ultimately to the point of imperial overextension and the detriment of American power, just as bin Laden and Zawahiri were hoping and betting they would. By granting these leaders the writ to keep us safe at any cost in this new fearful age, the people of this country have instead placed themselves in much greater danger. Our government helped create this international terrorist movement that they then provoked into turning against the American people. Then they exploited the blowback terrorist attacks, using them as an excuse to spread the war to countries that had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or their war against America. In playing the role of the rampaging empire, America's leaders have not only created the space for the spread of bin Ladenite fighters across the Middle East, but have allowed some of these most savage and formerly marginal groups of criminals and terrorists on Earth to portray themselves as brave heroes who saw the danger first and would dare to stand up to such overwhelming military power. I think you really
nailed it. Man, I should have had you read the audiobook. It sounds really good when you say it.
Well, I'm available if you want to do a retake.
I'm almost done.
But I think that's a really, you know, important statement that many people just, you know, if they think about all of these things at all, this doesn't tend to occur to them, it seems.
Yeah. Well, you know, Michael Scheuer said this back in 2004. He made news. You know, he was Mike in the original congressional report about the CIA, about, you know, the September 11th attack, the joint committee report. Mike, the CIA agent. And then when he released his book, the CIA made him put the name Anonymous on it. He wasn't supposed to admit who he was.
Right.
He finally completely quit the CIA and said, hey, world, I'm Michael Scheuer. And if people are familiar with this guy, he is brutally honest and to a fault, okay? He is pro-torture. I've heard him say absolutely genocidal things before. In his mind, he makes no bones about this. In his mind, a human life that has value is an American life. the rest of the lives on Earth, they better look out for what he and his people decide is best for us. That is absolutely his point of view, and he's brutally honest about it. And he came out and he said, look, everybody, you know, knowing there would be hell to pay for him, you understand, not caring at all, not giving a damn, having no more F's to give, so to speak. He quit the CIA because of the 9/11 Commission report, because it refused to tell the American people the truth. They hate us because of what our governments have done to them. That's what it's about. They don't hate us because of who they are and because of who we are. They hate us because George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton killed their people. That's what it's about. And then he said, the Iraq war is the hoped for but unexpected gift to bin Laden. This was in 2004, okay? Mm-hmm. This was a guy who knew that he was going to offend. This was a guy who knew that he was going, this was at the height of George W. Bush's America, you know?
Well, and when you interview Scheuer, he says the most incredibly strong statements in the most polite way. It's always yes, sir, no, sir, Mr. Collins. But
yeah, well, and sometimes he's perfectly rational and sometimes he's completely insane. I mean, I've heard him say, let's encourage all the Sunni and Shia to kill each other until they're all dead and, you know, insane things, too.
I have. So, I've heard that, too.
But that's, to me, it just proves the point. That this is a guy who is an American patriot to a fault. He is an America firster, you know, an ultimate America firster. And so what? In other words, if he really thought that, yeah, Islam makes people go psycho and kill Americans, then he would support nuking them all to death. He would. He would say, you know what? They hate us because of who they are. They're implacable. They're irrational. And our very goodness and existence provokes them, they must all be exterminated. I guarantee you that would be an exact quote of him if he believed for a second that that was true. And instead, he says, no, no, no. America started it.
Yeah, he has been brutally honest, and I have some respect for Mike Scheuer when he gets into the kind of the dark, crazy side. Not so much. Scott, you in Chapter 2 spend a fair amount of time talking about rendition, torture, and Guantanamo. And I appreciate that because I think these are important issues that many Americans, particularly now in the Trump era, see as symbols of strength. But in fact, they are really provocative icons, and our practices and these facilities really are recruitment devices, and they help radicalize the next round of jihadists.
Absolutely. I mean, and hey, look, we're recording this thing in October 2017. I mean, there's no question about this. We got testimony from all around about your last point there about the new enemies that this provokes. This is the history of Iraq War II and Afghanistan both. And, you know, for that matter, terrorists attacking Europe and America since have cited Guantanamo Bay and cited, you know, Abu Ghraib and Bagram and lawless American detention practices as their almost go-to ready propaganda answer to anyone who ever says anything to them about how they're the bad guys. They say, really? Look at these Americans claim that they care about democracy and human rights and the Statue of Liberty and all this stuff. And look at them, what they do. Tie up a man and then brutalize him and torture him when he's helpless to fight back. And that's the caricature of barbarism. That's what it means to be a barbarian, is that you are someone who tortures somebody. That's what it means. That's the antithesis of what we claim Western civilization is all about. That we are somehow, as Bill Hicks would say, evolved our ideas so that now we're better than that. That's medieval. We're past that now. And yet, no, we're not. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, yeah, no, but I'm the bad guy for defending myself from you. And we give them, and I'm not, you know, saying that they are purely defenders. They certainly attack civilians. But I'm just saying, in the chicken egg question here, the American Empire came first. And, you know, you mentioned Basevich there in the list of guests. Mm-hmm. Basevich's most recent book is The American War for the Greater Middle East.
Yep.
Right? And this mm-hmm. is a former army colonel, again, a conservative and a patriot. He's not a kook like Scheuer, on you know, saying horrible things like that. But he absolutely is a red, white, and blue George Washington kind of guy. And he's saying, listen, guys, it's not called the war on terrorism. It's called the war to be the dominant power in the Middle East. Terrorism is just a subset of that. Terrorism is a reaction to the larger imperial project. And you know what? Like, maybe if this was 2005, then some idiot at National Review would just be able to shout, oh, you know, Cindy Sheehan or something, and that supposedly would discredit this argument. But come on. I mean, what are we talking about? That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think Basevich is one of the most credible critics of America's misguided foreign policy of the last 20 years, who I can summon, you know, just when I think about who the powerful critics are.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And he says, you know, look, guys, come on. He's just being a grown up about it. He's an academic historian. He's saying, look, there's such a thing as a Carter Doctrine, and it predates September 11th by quite a bit. I mean, of course, you know, FDR made the first alliance with Saudi Arabia at the end of World War II. But Carter stepped it up big time. The Carter Doctrine, 1979, mm-hmm. which was announced in response to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which his administration officials later claimed that they deliberately baited the Russians into doing in the first place.
Let's credit Zbigniew Brzezinski here.
And Robert Gates as well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then they announced this Carter Doctrine that said America, not Saudi, not Iran, the Persians, America will be the dominant power in the Persian Gulf. And that's it. And we will not tolerate anybody's attempt, i.e. the Soviet Union. So don't even think about invading Iran, because that'll give you the Gulf. It won't give you the Gulf. We're already here. You know, well, this is huge. And then again, the Soviet Union's gone, but we're still there. And then, you know, of course, the first Iraq war was a great opportunity, which presented itself for the American empire to respond. And then we've been dealing with the blowback from that ever since. And of course, the blowback, since Americans don't pay attention to this kind of thing, blowback like September 11th can easily be portrayed as the first day of a brand new era and not something that happened in the middle of a bunch of things that were happening, which was the reality of the situation. As I say in the book, as I'm fond of saying, because it just worked out that way, and I think this is really powerful. Not that I'm a specialist in this kind of psychology or anything, but it seems pretty powerful to me. Mm. And when you see all those clips of the second plane hitting the building there, it's coming literally in the video out of the clear blue sky. It looks like something that's just a brand new thing. That's the cliche for something that takes you completely by surprise. It has no previous cause for it, out of the clear blue sky. And yet there it is. The plane came out of the clear blue sky. Who in the world? There were even people in those buildings which had been attacked before, who, when one of them was hit, they didn't think, oh my God, a terrorist attack. Right? I remember people thinking at the time that it was just another thing that happened, and not realizing that, I mean, not to play down the number of deaths, but not realizing that everyone else was going to see this as, like, quote, Pearl Harbor, a brand new thing to kick off a brand new era for which any antecedents need go unmentioned, you know, because, you know, like Harry Brown, for example, wrote an article for antiwar.com called When Will We Learn? That was published on September the 12th. And just said, look, man, we've been bombing Iraq from bases in Saudi for 10, 12 years. You guys all know this, okay? And boy, did he get in some heat for that. But he was just saying, what did you think was going to happen? Nothing?
Scott, when Obama was campaigning, he was quite a chameleon, because he tapped into the anti-Bush sentiment and was perceived as broadly anti-war. And after he got the nomination is when he voted for the FISA law that he said he would oppose. And then he articulated that, you know, we've got to take care of this thing in Afghanistan. And it became the basis for him, as I mentioned earlier, to prove that he wasn't a wimp or a peacenik. But also, he took the advice of generals. You know, he pulled everybody in and he said, all options are on the table. Well, the only option that really wasn't on the table was withdrawal. And Obama was captive as someone who was inexperienced in military and foreign policy. And what do you think it was that led him not to just the initial surge, but to the second surge that for about 18 months took the troop levels to 100,000, and with the contractors, we were, you know, exceeding 200,000 pairs of so-called boots on the ground in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and 40,000 NATO troops at the same time. And then, look, I mean, the whole thing was a joke. I mean, not it was not a funny thing, but it was known at the time by all making the choice. The military commanders, Obama's war cabinet, the principals committee, they all knew that it was nonsense. It was just politics, man. The economics of politics. You're a Democratic president, black skin, weird name, to the left of Hillary, getting us out of Iraq. As you say, you gotta, you know, protect your right flank somehow. So scapegoat the Afghans. I quote, I believe it's author Ostri Serkey in my book, saying that this had long been a tradition in Europe, saying we shouldn't be in Iraq. We should go to Afghanistan instead. And that was their same political trick of wanting to not be in Iraq, but or wanting to oppose Iraq, but not look weak kind of thing. And then so in the politics of 2009, I mean, the entire liberal and democratic progressive grassroots, I mean, all the way to the even the socialists, most of them, maybe excluding the real hardcore leftists and communists, were just so in love with Obama that he could have been killing Afghan women and children with his own bare hands and they wouldn't have given a damn. And that's a fact. And he knew that. So he knew that, you know what, I can escalate this war and it's not going to cost me. On the other hand, if I don't escalate this war, John McCain and Lindsey Graham are just going to barbecue me every damn day from now on about what a coward I am and how everything in Afghanistan is my fault because I ever left. And I already got to deal with that over Iraq. I can't do two at once. So he gave in to protect his right flank from the Republicans and from the generals and from the media who would clearly take their side, and knowing that it wouldn't cost him anything among his progressive base. And it didn't. Hey, he was safely reelected.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
so
and,
his
and
calculations
despite,
seemed to pay off.
Despite the expansive use of drones, Obama tripled or quadrupled Bush's record, particularly in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You know, what I refer to Americans, the American attitude toward the war in Afghanistan as whatever. You know, you're going to increase the troops, you're going to bring them out, you know, you're going to bring in NATO, you're going to Afghanize the war, you're going to drop $1 trillion, you know, on our expenses and hundreds of billions on the failed training of the Afghan military and police. And the public just shrugs. And when Trump went public this summer, and in the book, I get the sense that you were kind of hoping that he was going to surprise us and actually announce a full withdrawal. And you kind of make the case for that in your final chapter. But ultimately, the same forces suck in a Trump that sucked in Obama.
Yep. And again, screw the Afghans, right? Their lives have nothing to do with this. What's best for them has nothing to do with this. Question is, what's best for Trump? What's best for Trump is go along with the generals. And in fact, you'll probably have noticed this in the campaign. If you go back, say, a year and a half ago, especially, go back that far, he would say, the rise of ISIS has all been is all. I always do this. I always either call Osama bin Laden Bill Clinton or I call Barack Obama Osama bin Laden. He would say, the rise of ISIS is all Barack Obama's fault. And then it's like, okay, cross your fingers. How is he going to finish this, right?
Right, yeah.
And he would say then, because he supported the bad guys in Libya and in Syria, and that's what ended up leading to the rise of the Islamic State blown back into Iraq. I think Bannon must have told them to say it that way. I'm not sure who told them to say it that way, but hell yeah, man. That was knocking it out of the park, and that was putting the blame directly on Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and right where it belonged for taking, you know, for the policy that they chose of taking the side of the Israelis, the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris in backing al-Qaeda forces in Syria, especially Libya too, but then especially in Syria. And then he would also add at the end, though, and he got our troops out of Iraq. So then when ISIS rolled in, there was no one there to stop him.
Well, right? let's
but
break
then
that
what
down.
Happened
let's,
was,
wait, just a minute. Let's break that down, because Obama tried desperately to upend the Bush administration's agreement to leave Iraq. And in the final stages, he had Panetta over there every other week, trying to set up a status of forces agreement so that we could keep more troops in, right. in Iraq. And when the Iraqis, what was that guy's name, Maliki, objected and refused, then Obama claimed victory, said that we're getting out just like I promised, and acted as if he had never played the other game. And as right. to, you know, the claim from Trump that he and Hillary were essentially the founders of the Islamic State, you know, that's a very bizarre argument that doesn't have any rational basis. Their bad policies certainly enabled the Islamic State to move into the vacuum created by the civil war in Syria that was stoked by the United States. And we saw them as useful
players. Well, that's exactly what he meant by it. I mean, that's exactly what he meant by it. That was what they asked him, and that was what he said, and he nailed it. But then here's the thing, and my point was that, and I agree with you that Obama did try to stay. I wouldn't want to give Obama really credit for getting out of there. I think maybe he could have tried a little bit harder. But remember, Chelsea Manning released the documents that proved American war crimes, including the execution of a baby at point blank range and the calling in of an airstrike to try to cover it up. And this was at the last minute and really, you know, made it impossible, even if Maliki really wanted to let the Americans stay at that point. And I don't even think he really wanted to. You're definitely right about that. But the point being is this, is Trump got it right, that it wasn't America getting out of Iraq that caused the rise of ISIS. It was further intervention, post-Iraq War II intervention by Obama in Libya and Syria. That's what really led to the rise of ISIS. And then he would also add, oh, and he left Iraq too. But now, of course, he's dropped that whole first part. And now he blames the rise of ISIS on Obama getting out of Iraq, full stop.
Right.
None of this stuff about intervention in Libya and Syria anymore. And in his Afghanistan speech, he invoked that same framing and said, look what happened when that weak loser wimp Obama pulled out of Iraq. That's what led to the rise of ISIS. So therefore, lesson in D.C. politics, the lesson is clear. It's black and white. It only takes a sentence or two. You can hear. See what happened when Obama left Iraq? That's why we can't leave Afghanistan. That's it. And think about it. It's only halfway through his first year in office, right? So what if he did leave Afghanistan right now? Then just like everybody blames everything that happened in Iraq on Obama leaving Iraq, everybody would blame everything bad happening in Afghanistan on Trump leaving. Now, of course, the same reasoning should say that he gets all the blame for everything bad that happens there while our troops are there. But of course, the spin there is, no, they're giving it their best effort.
And nobody
that
cares.
Anything that happens is happening despite their best efforts, not because of them.
Well, there is no political price that will be paid.
That's right. He pays no political price for doing it. He only scores in the Republican Party, and the Democrats don't have anything to say about it because it was their man Obama did the same thing a minute ago, and they didn't have anything to say about it then, and they're too busy distracted with all their identity, skin color politics, and everything other than war. So,
Scott, as we wrap up at the in the final chapter of Fool's Errand, you make a strong case that it is futile for the United States to remain in Afghanistan. You reiterate that we are the central cause for the ongoing conflict, and until we leave, whoever comprises what we call the Taliban today will be fomenting opposition, and the warlords and the disparate groups, these tribal elements in Afghanistan, will continue a conflict against the oppressive invader. Do you think we will ever get that?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, honestly, the only person I could imagine actually ending this war would be Ron Paul. And it's too late for him to run again. He's in, you know, almost his mid-80s now. But I can't imagine anyone else in politics who would say, you know what? I don't care what Lindsey Graham says. Bring it. And you know what? You can bring any goofball two-star general up here, too, and I'm not afraid of them. No idiot, you know, meathead general is going to push me around. His job is executing policy. My job is making it up, and I say pack it up and come home. That's what it would take. It would take an American president giving a speech to the American people saying, today, you and I tell the national security state to go to hell. We're going to do what we want, not what they want. We're going to end this war right now. Are you with me? That's what it would take. And I can't think of a single person in American politics who could ever do that in a million years. Could actually be the president and do something like that. I mean, in fact, as crazy as it is, the only person maybe who could have, other than Ron, would be Donald Trump. Because he is exactly the kind of SOB to say, hey, this is all Bush and Obama's fault. This isn't even America's fault. It's just their fault. Stupid, goofball, idiot Jeb's brother George and weak, loser, wimpy, dopey Obama. They made bad decisions, but that's not my fault. And they made enemies out of the Pashtuns, but I say the Pashtuns aren't our enemies anymore. And they created some stupid government in Kabul that can't stand on its own? Well, I don't know why Americans should be obligated forever to support a government that still can't stand on its own after 16 years. Maybe it's a fool's errand. Maybe we shouldn't be there. Go to hell, everybody. I'm Donald Trump. Good night. Right? He could do that. He's Donald Trump. He could flip-flop on anything and get away with it. But, of course, he only flip-flops for the worse on everything, never for the better.
Now, Scott, could you just write the tweet for him? You almost did there.
I've tried very many times, actually. I used to try to do this kind of faux flattery and just say, you know, listen, you're tall and strong and rich and incredibly successful.
And you got a really big dick.
Don't listen to McMaster. He's a traitor. He's in it with Petraeus against you, you know, and just it didn't take.
Well, Scott, we don't agree on everything, but I really enjoyed airing this out with you. You're a very thoughtful, well-informed guy. And I want to commend you because you, on each page, you show the footnotes and the sources that you used. And there is a wide range from corporate media to the voices that we identified earlier, starting with Gareth Porter, but also your own body of original interviews. And I think that's very enterprising. And I think that you have a book that is well worth reading and makes a lot of important arguments.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for saying that, too.
All right, Scott. Great to talk with you. You take care.
Appreciate you, too.
Thanks again to Robert Blumen for connecting me with Scott Horton. I remain your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails. Smiling under